I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I think a lot of U.S. leaders have no clue as to modern history, but they resent China's rise. That is an affront to the United States. How dare China rise? This is our world. This is our century.
As tension escalates between the United States and China, we'll look at how Beijing is increasing its diplomatic activity across the globe, from offering a peace plan to end the war in Ukraine, to brokering talks that led to Saudi Arabia and Iran resuming ties. We'll speak to professor and economist Jeffrey Sachs. Then President Biden, who's just announced he's running for re-election, has formed a White House Office of Environmental Justice.
Under this order, environmental justice will become the responsibility of every single federal agency. I mean, every single federal agency.
We'll be joined by Indigenous Diné activist Jade Begay, who's on the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Plus, we look at the firing of Tucker Carlson at Fox News. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, a 72-hour ceasefire appears to be largely holding, though there are reports of scattered gunfire and shelling in the capital, Khartoum. Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces agreed to begin the three-day truce at midnight following 2 days of negotiations brokered by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. At least 459 civilians have died since fighting between the rival factions of Sudan's military junta broke out on April 15th, though the true toll is certain to be far higher. Water, food, medicine, electricity and communications remain in short supply. Damage to sanitation systems have spawned fears of waterborne diseases like cholera, as some residents have been forced to drink water directly from the Nile River. This is Rawan Awalid, who left her family behind in Khartoum as she fled to Egypt.
I left behind my brother, my family, the rest of my aunts and my friends. Yes, I survived, but I'm still worried about those I left behind. The situation is extremely catastrophic. There are no hospitals. 55 hospitals are out of service. This is very bad. I don't know how they are living.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is warning of a high risk of biological hazards in Khartoum after fighters seized control of a national laboratory holding pathogens, including measles and polio virus. Ukraine's military has advanced onto the eastern bank of the Dnieper River in the Kherson region as part of a long-anticipated spring counteroffensive against Russian forces. A spokesperson for Ukraine's military refused to confirm the reports, but said heavy Russian shelling in the region had injured civilians and destroyed dozens of buildings, including a school. China's foreign ministry has walked back comments by a senior Chinese diplomat questioning the sovereignty of Ukraine and other former Soviet states. Liu Shai, China's ambassador to France, said on Friday the nations, quote, do not have an effective status in international law, unquote. That prompted several nations, including Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, to summon Chinese envoys to explain Beijing's official position. In a statement, China's foreign ministry said Liu's comments were not a political declaration, but an expression of personal points of view during a televised debate, unquote. We'll have more on this story after headlines. A new report finds worldwide military spending rose to an all-time high of over $2.2 trillion last year, largely driven by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The United States accounted for nearly 40% of total military spending, even though it's just over 4% of the world's population. The U.S. also remained the world's largest arms exporter by far. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris will run for re-election in 2024. Biden made the official announcement this morning with a 3-minute campaign video posted on social media.
freedom, personal freedom, is fundamental to who we are as Americans.
There's nothing more important, nothing more sacred.
That's been the work of my first term, to fight for our democracy.
This shouldn't be a red or blue issue.
To protect our rights, to make sure that everyone in this country is treated equally.
So far, Biden and Harris face two Democratic primary challengers, self-help author Marianne Williamson, who also ran in 2020, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an environmental lawyer, anti-vaccine activist, and son of the former U.S. Attorney General and assassinated 1968 presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy. CBS News reports RFK Jr. was convinced to run by Trump's former campaign manager, Steve Bannon, who believes he will be a useful chaos agent in the 2024 race. Fox News announced Monday the cable network and its far-right primetime host, Tucker Carlson, quote, agreed to part ways, unquote. His departure was effective immediately. Interim presenters are replacing Carlson, who has not commented about the reason for his firing. The surprise departure of the top-rated host comes after text messages from Carlson were revealed in the Dominion Voting Systems lawsuit against Fox News for airing false claims of a stolen election that was just settled last week for over $750 million. Later in the broadcast, we'll look at how Tucker Carlson has been a singular force driving Fox News's extremism. Meanwhile, CNN's fired news anchor Don Lemon, ending his 17-year tenure at the network. Lemon was accused of sexism after he recently said 51-year-old Republican presidential hopeful Nikki Haley was past her prime. And Variety reported earlier this month Lemon had a history of threatening and mocking female staffers at CNN. In Atlanta, Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis has revealed she'll announce this summer whether she's filing criminal charges against Donald Trump and others over Trump's effort to overturn Joe Biden's victory in Georgia in 2020. Willis wrote in a letter to law enforcement she expects to announce possible criminal indictments between July 11th and September 1st and is asking for heightened security and preparedness. Here in New York, jury selection has begun in a civil trial against Donald Trump brought by author E. Jean Carroll. The former magazine columnist alleges Trump raped her in a dressing room at a department store in the mid-90s. Carroll can bring the case decades later because New York opened a one-year window on statute of limitations for adult survivors of sexual assault. The judge in the civil case has ruled two other women who say they were sexually assaulted by Trump can take the stand as well. The chair of the Senate Finance Committee has asked Texas billionaire and conservative activist Harlan Crow to provide Congress with a detailed list of undisclosed gifts and payments benefiting Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, including private real estate transactions and the use of Crow's private jet and superyacht. In a letter sent to Crow Monday, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden wrote, quote, "The secrecy surrounding your dealings with Justice Thomas is simply unacceptable. The American public deserves a full account of the full extent of your largesse towards Justice Thomas, including whether these gifts complied with all relevant federal tax and ethic laws," unquote. Meanwhile, Bloomberg News is reporting Justice Thomas failed to recuse himself from a 2005 Supreme Court decision to reject a case that benefited the Trammell Crow Residential Company, a real estate firm named after Harlan Crow's father that was partly owned by the Crow family. Harlan Crow was CEO and chair of the board at the time. In North Dakota, Republican Governor Doug Burgum has signed into law a near-total ban on abortion that would only allow people to get the procedure in cases of rape or incest during the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. The legislation is one of the most severe anti-abortion measures in the country. Reproductive rights advocates say most people don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. In Montana, protesters rallied inside the state capitol Monday and supported Democratic transgender state representative Zoe Saphir after Republican lawmakers blocked her from speaking on the House floor for a third day. Saphir raised her microphone into the air as her supporters interrupted proceedings for nearly half an hour, leading to the arrest of at least seven people.
Our guests will come to order. Sergeant of Arms, will you please clear the gallery?
Republicans have denied Zephyr's repeated request to debate on proposed anti-trans legislation after last week she told them they would have blood on their hands if they banned gender-affirming health care for trans children and youth. Meanwhile, in Tennessee, Grammy-winning rapper and singer Lizzo invited dozens of drag performers on stage during a concert in Knoxville Friday night, protesting Republicans' efforts to ban public drag performances in the state. Tennessee Republican Governor Bill Lee signed the measure into law last February, but it was blocked by a federal judge the following month, arguing it was too vaguely written. President Biden Monday welcomed Tennessee Democratic Representatives Justin Pearson, Justin Jones, and Gloria Johnson to the White House for a discussion on gun reform. The lawmakers became known as the Tennessee Three after facing Republican-led expulsion votes from the state legislature for supporting recent student protests calling for gun control after six people, including 3 9-year-old students, were killed in a mass shooting at a Nashville elementary school in March. Pearson and Jones, who were the only two former expelled, were unanimously reappointed to the Tennessee House of Representatives by local officials in Memphis and Nashville earlier this month. This is Justin Jones speaking Monday from the Rose Garden.
We lifted this issue above the partisan divide, that this is not left or right, but we talked to the president about how this is a moral issue, an issue of conscience, an issue in the South where we are trying to build multiracial democracy and challenge these extreme forces that, rather than passing an assault weapons ban, they assaulted our democracy, as we saw when we were expelled from the state legislature.
In Pennsylvania, the trial for the man accused of killing 11 worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018 began Monday. The mass shooting was the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. In Kentucky, the Carroll County Sheriff's Office has hired the former Louisville police detective who fired the shot that killed 26-year-old black emergency room technician Breonna Taylor in her own home during a no-knock raid in March 2020. Miles Cosgrove was fired from the Louisville Metro Police Department in January 2021 for violating use of force procedures and failing to use a body camera. In northwestern Pakistan, at least 17 people were killed, more than 50 others wounded Monday as a pair of explosions tore through an ammunition depot run by Pakistan's counterterrorism office in the Swat Valley. Most of the dead were police officers, though at least four were civilians. A police spokesperson said the blast was triggered when ammunition caught fire, likely due to an electrical short circuit. And the 2022 Goldman Environmental Prize recipients have been announced. In Brazil, the indigenous leader Alessandra Korap won for leading a campaign against the mining giant Anglo American, safeguarding 400,000 acres of Amazon rainforest.
It was a huge victory. We realized that we are like little ants. When the little ants join forces, we get stronger. And we got stronger until we won the battle against Anglo American.
United States, environmental activist and fourth-generation shrimper Diane Wilson also received a Goldman Prize for winning a historic $50 million settlement in a case against Formosa Plastics for dumping toxic waste on Texas's Gulf Coast. The 2019 civil settlement was the largest in the history of the Clean Water Act. This is Diane Wilson.
Formosa makes a trillion pellets or nurdles a day, and they lose a lot of the powder in the pellets through 10 storm water outfalls. And so Formosa was discharging this plastic everywhere. And they have been doing this for 27 years.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, professor and economist Jeffrey Sachs on the growing influence of China around the world. Stay with us.
Too dangerous to keep. Too feeble to let go. And you want to bite the hand. Should have stopped this long ago. Go now,
by the church. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
China is facing criticism in Europe after China's ambassador to France questioned the sovereignty of former Soviet states under international law during a television interview. The Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, condemned the remarks and summoned Chinese envoys to explain Beijing's official position. The Chinese foreign ministry walked back the ambassador's comments, saying, quote, China respects all countries' sovereignty, independence and territorial integrity. The diplomatic spat comes as China is making headlines across the globe, though maybe not so much in the United States, for its diplomatic efforts. In late February, China released a 12-point peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. On March 10th, Iran and Saudi Arabia announced they would restore ties as part of an agreement brokered by China. Days later, in mid-March, Chinese President Xi Jinping hosted the Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva to talk about Ukraine, trade, and moving away from the U.S. dollar. Xi Jinping then met with French President Emmanuel Macron in Beijing. During Macron's visit, she spoke about the roles of China and France in world affairs.
The world today is undergoing profound historic changes. As permanent members of the UN Security Council and major countries with a tradition of independence, China and France, as promoters of the multipolarization of the world and the democratization of international relations, have the ability and responsibility to transcend difference and restraints, adhere to the comprehensive strategic cooperative partnerships between China and France with stability, reciprocity, development, and progress, practice true multilateralism and maintain world peace, stability, and prosperity.
While in Beijing, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, suggested France and European nations should not become a vassal of the United States when it comes to Taiwan.
France supports the single China policy and the search for a peaceful solution to the situation, for that matter. It's Europe's position. It's a position that has always been compatible with the role of an ally. But it's precisely why I'm stressing the importance of strategic autonomy. Ally doesn't mean being a vassal. It's not because we do things together that we can't think alone, that we're going to follow the people in that are the toughest in a country that's allied with us. When we look at the facts, France has lessons to be received from no one, be either in Ukraine, in Sahel, or in Taiwan.
China's continued its diplomatic outreach by offering last week to hold talks between Israel and Palestine. To look more at China's recent diplomatic actions, we're joined by Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University and president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. He's also served as advisor to three UN secretaries general and currently serves as a Sustainable Development Solutions Advocate under Secretary General Antonio Guterres. His latest article published is headlined "The Need for a New U.S. Foreign Policy." Professor Sachs, thanks so much for being with us. All of the diplomatic gestures of China, you know, the meeting with Macron in Beijing, with Lula in Beijing, brokering this deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia, now offering not only to negotiate between Ukraine and Russia, but Israel and Palestine. This hardly gets attention in the United States media. But around the world, the headlines are far more, there are far more headlines about this. Talk about the significance of this, and you, if you see a direct parallel between all the headway that China is making and increasing U.S. hostility towards China.
Thanks, Amy. Very good to be with you. And indeed, this is a crucial topic. And as President Xi Jinping said in that meeting with Macron, this is a historic watershed that the world is living through right now. What China is after, if we view it from China's perspective, is what was also said, true multilateralism. And what that means, or true multipolarity, another term that they use. And that means they don't want a U.S.-led world. They want a multipolar world. And the basis of that is that the United States is 4.1% of the world population. China is 17.5% of the world population. China's economy is comparable to the U.S. economy, and indeed China is the lead trade partner for much of the world. So China is saying, we're there too, alongside you. We want a multipolar world. We don't want a U.S.-led world. And while the United States sometimes talks about a rule-based order, the fact of the matter is that the U.S. grand strategy, if we can use that term of the grand strategists of the U.S. State, see our grand strategy in the United States as being dominance. And I often refer to an article that I think is very clear, succinct, and revealing by a former colleague of mine at Harvard University, Robert Blackwell, an esteemed ambassador of the United States, who wrote in 2015, and I'll quote from the article, "Since its founding, the United States has consistently pursued a grand strategy focused on acquiring and maintaining preeminent power over various rivals, first on the North American continent, then in the Western Hemisphere, and finally globally." Well, China doesn't want the United States to be the preeminent power. It wants to live alongside the United States. Blackwell, writing in 2015, said China's rise is a threat to U.S. preeminence. And he laid out a series of steps that the Biden administration actually is following almost step by step. What Blackwell laid out already back in 2015 is that the United States should create, quote, new preferential trading arrangements among U.S. friends and allies to increase their mutual gains through instruments that consciously exclude China. There should be a technology control regime to block China's strategic capabilities, a buildup of, quote, power political capacities of U.S. friends and allies on China's periphery, and strengthen U.S. military forces along the Asian rimland despite any Chinese opposition. This has become the Biden foreign policy. China knows it. China really is pushing back. But what's very important and interesting to understand, and we've seen it clearly in the dynamics involving the Ukraine war, most of the world also does not want the U.S. as the global preeminent power. Most of the world wants a multipolar world and is therefore not lined up behind the United States sanctions on Russia and so forth. And this was also the message of President Lula visiting China, saying to President Xi Jinping, we as Brazil also want multipolarity, true multipolarity, and we want peace, for example, in the Russian-Ukraine war that is based on not a U.S. perception of dominance, say NATO enlargement, but rather a peace that reflects a multipolar world. This is real. It's happening all over the world. And the fact of the matter is, the reason why this is a historic watershed is that the underlying economics and technological change have made it so. The U.S. is no longer the dominant world economy, and the G7, which is the U.S., Canada, Britain, France, Italy, Germany, and Japan, is actually smaller than the BRICS countries in economic size, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So we really are, in fact, in a multipolar world, but in ideology, we're in a conflict.
But Jeffrey Sachs, I wanted to ask about that. You mentioned the BRICS. The BRICS Bank that is now in China, and President Lula has named Dilma Rousseff as the head of the BRICS Bank. Its importance in terms of this multipolarity of in the world economies, the potential for even the creation of alternative major currencies to the dollar as a result of the BRICS alliance, the impact of that on world affairs.
This is a big deal. And in fact, the United States is withdrawing. It doesn't know it necessarily. Our politicians don't understand this, but our politicians are withdrawing from the world financial and monetary scene and opening up the space for a completely different kind of international finance. I'll give you an example. The U.S. was the creator of the World Bank. But now the U.S. Congress won't put new money into the World Bank. And because of that, the World Bank's actually a quite small institution. It's got a big name, but it's a quite small institution in the financial scheme of things. The U.S. won't put more money in. The Congress says, no, why should we waste our money internationally and so forth? And you get a lot of hubbub about that. So China and the rest of the BRICS say, okay, we'll make our own development bank. And they established the new development bank, or sometimes called the BRICS Bank, based in Shanghai. And that's just one of the institutions that is really changing the scene. There's the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, based in Beijing, in fact. There is, as President Lula said, and it's happening also in the context of the Ukraine war, a move away from the use of the dollar, which the United States has thought, well, that's our ace in the hole. You know, that is our ultimate hold on things, because we can use sanctions. We can use our financial control to keep other countries in line. But other countries are saying, not so much. We'll trade in renminbi. We'll trade in rubles. We'll trade in rupees. We'll trade in our own national currencies. And they're quickly setting up alternative institutions to do this. The United States doubles down. We will confiscate your reserves. We will, if you don't follow. And the other countries are saying, you know, if you want to go through the UN and get really multilateral rules, we're with you. But if you want to just impose the rules, we won't follow along. And so we have this very funny expression called a rule-based international order. The United States government uses it every day. But what does it mean? Who writes the rules? And what most of the world wants, in fact, is rules written in a multipolar or multilateral setting, not rules written by the United States and a few friends and allies.
I wanted to ask you, you've been an advisor to the United Nations for quite often. The issue of how much longer the permanent members of the Security Council can keep the number to five, because clearly Brazil and other countries of the global south have been saying the UN needs to be reformed. And countries from Latin America, specifically Brazil and Africa, should have representation on the UN Security Council, permanent members.
Yes, you know, the P5, the permanent five, which is the United States, China, Russia, France, and the United Kingdom, was the World War II victor group in 1945. They wrote into the rules of the UN, incidentally, that they would be the permanent Security Council members and have a veto over any change.